Welcome back to the Real World Podcast. We are debuting a new series, but don't get too comfortable with it. We are only doing three episodes of this. Big Spideas. Mike Thomas is a master of puns, and he's here with me. How are you, Mike? In an echoey chamber of echoes.
Yes, you and I kind of function as our own echo chamber, so I thought, why not go into a room where you could probably hear an echo of what I'm saying after every word I say? Because we can get like three versions of the exact same opinion.
I mean, you sound like you're a comic book villain right now. It's very menacing. I am afraid, but I will persevere.
I've got a little scratch in my throat too, so a little more nasally. So, you know, that's kind of contributing to the sense of villainy.
Okay, so speaking of villains, with Big Spideas, as you can guess, we are going to be talking about Spider-Man. And the Spider-Man franchise has a lot of villains. One of them has too many villains. Preview for the
one
next.
One of them is Mark Webb.
So we're going to do an episode on each incarnation of live-action Spider-Man. So next week will be the Mark Webb Amazing Verse. And the week after that, if we've timed all this right, will be Tom Holland as Spider-Man in Homecoming. But for now, it's Sam Raimi, and if you're a long-time listener to this podcast, you may know some vague thoughts that Mike and myself share on the Raimi Spider-Man. If not, strap in, because you're about to hear it. We're not going to go through these film by film. It's just going to be a very broad strokes. Here's what Raimi saw for the character, and here are some examples of it from all three films. Just to get the ball rolling, I think these are as overrated as a superhero movie gets. They are remembered as being, you know, among the best comic book movies. People look at Doc Ock as like the best villain in comic book movies and stuff, and I will posit until the day I die that people have this strong opinion on these, because they remember them coming out when they were teenagers and there really wasn't a hell of a lot for it to compete with. And there's no way that Spider-Man 1 and 2 are better than X-Men 1 and 2.
Yes, I think for me personally, the non-existent battle between the first two X-Men and the first two Spider-Man in terms of the battle of public opinion and financial success was one that aggravated me from day one. Mm-hmm. And this kind of just, the fact that it wasn't even like discussed, it was just kind of accepted that Spider-Man was the best. It was just kind of like, what the fuck is going on? What is wrong with all you people? You know, Sam Raimi presented a very unchallenging, simplistic take on Spider-Man that, especially with the first two films, really just aimed for the middle and on a narrative and character level. And I think for the most part, he connected. He successfully shot for the middle and got there. It's still the middle, though, and the middle might even be a generous description of how to describe it. But at the same time, I do think it's important to contextualize it, as we often did for X-Men. Up until this point, there was only, X-Men was still very much an outlier in terms of how ambitious a superhero movie can be, how much you can introduce shades of gray, nuance, and motivation. And I watched these first two Spider-Man, actually all three of them really, and I really take it back to the Burton and Schumacher Batman movies, in the sense that it was what seems to be a far more traditional, there's a hero, there's a girl, and there is a villain that, in the end, well, I think the upgrade was that the Spider-Man villains, there was a sense of decency to them, at least at one point. In the Batman movies, by the time we meet them, they're just cartoonishly evil. Uh-huh. But the Spider-Man movies definitely embrace the cartoonishly evil side throughout a lot of the movies. It's just that they usually use outside factors like chemicals, alien spawn, radioactive chips, or whatever the fuck, as the cause of the evil.
Yes.
But as a way to...
Tragic motivation assisted by some kind of external force, and then they are freed from it by the end and have a moment of reflection and then die anyway.
Yes, which is more nuanced than Jack Nicholson's The Joker or Danny DeVito's The Penguin or Tommy Lee Jones' Two-Face or Jim Carrey's The Riddler or Uma Thurman's
Poison Ivy.
Poison Ivy. they are technically more nuanced than that, but the being more nuanced than that is, you know, virtually not even a bar to get over. It's literally the ground. It's literally just taking a step over the ground. So I don't want to say they deserve credit for that, but it makes more sense when you think back in terms of, well, you know, this first one came out only 5 years after the last Batman movie. You know, it's been almost a decade since Iron Man, for instance. And, you know, we've seen how much comic book movies have evolved since Iron Man to a certain degree. But the other thing that's interesting is that the success of Spider-Man clearly inspired Marvel in their early years. Iron Man feels very much like a Spider-Man movie in terms of its simplistic scope, its unchallenging way of telling its story, presenting its characters. And that's not to say that you or others might not like Iron Man a lot more or think it's a lot better. I mean, that's just like a matter of taste, enjoyment, et cetera. But I do think you see the DNA in Spider-Man still to this day, far more than you see the DNA of X-Men, for instance.
Sure.
And I think on a superficial level, you see the DNA of Nolan's Dark Knight trilogy, but, you know, we've discussed that. But I think in a lot of ways, Spider-Man still, in some ways, is probably the most influential comic book property.
There are arguments to be made it saved Marvel as a company, not as a, you know, film studio was a way off. They were bankrupt when this was starting to get made. And the success of this reignited them as a company and propelled them forward. And it's absolutely, I think, the... I mean, there were comic book movies coming out, and there are decent ones that are smaller, like Blade and X-Men.
And more ambitious ones like Ang Lee's Hulk.
Sure, you know, like absolutely. Her. But in terms of, like, huge blockbuster tentpole, this was kind of in a league of its own for a while.
Yeah, like this was the standard.
Like those Batman, the Schumacher Batman movies, they were big, and like they may even have been as big as Spider-Man, and I may just be.
I think forever. I think Robin, Batman and Robin, was kind of roundly considered a complete misfire and failure.
But just, you know, in terms of that, like Superman, the Richard Donner Superman was huge. But it had been decades since that, and those Superman films had gone off by the wayside. The Batman films were struggling with each iteration. Like the Burton ones, you know, we discussed Batman. But Spider-Man then swung onto the scene as an enormous moneymaker and, like, huge cultural penetration. And for that reason, it is revered as such. And I think it's just a case of, like, the new stuff isn't as good as the old stuff kind of mentality, because I haven't watched these through in full in a long time, and doing so to prepare for this, I was taken aback at how the first two, I think, are just very okay. I think the first one is actually better than the second one, even though that is generally not the held opinion. Thank you. And that third one is still hot garbage. The second one, I didn't remember being as dull as it is. They make some attempts to ground it and have the middle portion be almost completely devoid of action. And like, I'm not saying you have to throw a punch or have an explosion every 5 minutes or I'm going to lose interest, but it's not. I don't think they execute it quite right. I don't know. It's not great. It's just not great. It's not bad, but they're good. They're okay.
Yeah, you know, people's love for the first two, and I think specifically for the second one. The second one, when it came out, was kind of roundly considered to be one of, if not the best superhero movie. I think a popular line was since the first Superman, which is a whole separate issue that we don't have time to get into. And I still don't see it. I mean,
Blade is better than all three of these Spider-Man films, I would say.
We will rewatch Blade soon, and we can have that debate then. I'm not prepared to make a judgment on that either.
X-Men 1 and 2 are better than Spider-Man 1.
I mean, that's not even an issue. That's not even close.
Yeah.
And I even think, even saying that comment at the time really doesn't hold much weight, in the sense that it's not really going up against anything.
But people still do it, though.
Yeah. It's still... Well, I think there just hasn't been enough reevaluation of it. And, or it's easy to dismiss and be like, well, you know, even if you don't like it as much now, at the time it was amazing or something like that. Well, you know, maybe it should have been considered amazing at the time. Yeah. But, you know, I think, as I've said, I think it's DNA. You can still see it in the DNA. I think I really think the first two Spider-Man really provided the blueprint that a lot of superhero movies have tried to follow since. Even up through Doctor Strange, I think most recently, really, you can still see that standard superhero girl villain, that triumphant blueprint, that you can still see it. And I know that's not like, it's not that Spider-Man created that idea, of course.
No.
But it's more that in terms of the superhero cinematic experience, like those key three elements, I think were just kind of firmly ingrained in Spider-Man as being like, this is what makes a successful superhero movie.
Yeah.
And all superhero movies should follow this if they want to be successful.
Yeah. There's a lot of shots and scenes and styles of scene that are iconic to the genre, and you do still see iterations of constantly. Like, there are films coming out this year that will do some of the stuff that you see in this in Spider-Man 1.
Yeah, and so I think, like, let's get into specifically the first two Spider-Man.
Yeah, because that third one, it's just going to be...
The third one's a whole separate discussion. I think that kind of needs its own discussion, because the third one's kind of...
Sure.
You can see the remnants of 1 and 2 in it, and obviously it's very much a Sam Raimi movie, and the same actors, same writers, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But it's kind of a whole separate discussion because of how much of a mess it is. These first two movies, Spider-Man 1 and Spider-Man 2.
Yeah, 2002, 2004, Sam Raimi.
The basic idea is that the first one is Peter Parker slowly becoming Spider-Man at the same time. And what I actually think is relatively clever, while he's slowly becoming Spider-Man and becoming more and more confident in his Spider-Man-y-ness, his Willem Dafoe's Norman Osborn is slowly becoming the Green Goblin. Both have been... if Norman Osborn chose his powers to a certain extent, Spider-Man did accidentally got his powers. But, you know, they're both slowly morphing into these alternate alter egos, I should say. And they both kind of slowly kind of accepting the fact that this is really now who they are. And I actually think they do a relatively subtle job of doing that.
Yeah, they are mirrored.
For a film that is not very subtle, and nor does it really attempt to be subtle all that much, that idea at least is relatively subtle and does make for a nice, like, I don't say poetic, that might be too generous, but like a balanced story. It works. It makes it very watchable.
Yeah, they're going on mirrored journeys. They're both men of science.
Yes, mirrored journeys. There we go.
And like, you even have like Norman saying, basically preferring Peter to his son Harry, in that he's trying to get Harry to take handouts aggressively, and Harry is sort of reluctantly taking them. And then when he offers the same to Peter and he says no, he respects him for it and is like, oh, that's like me. And it's like, you can't have it both ways, bro. But yeah, you see that these two are kind of kindred in a way, and they are going on their mirrored transformations.
Yeah. At the same time, though, the one scene where they really try to bring it up, where Norman Osborn's like, or Green Goblin's talking to Spider-Man, for some reason doesn't unmask him.
Oh, fucking, you lose 100 points every time you don't do shit like that. Like,
he says, you know, you and me are not that at all different. Eventually these people will turn on you. I'm just like, okay, that's hitting it a little too far.
Yeah.
That was the one moment where it was really lost on any of its subtlety.
That scene's garbage. Like, you could cut that scene right out.
Yeah. But yeah, it obviously builds to a big showdown because, you know, they never want Spider-Man to have any really shade of gray to him. It's Norman who ends up killing himself.
Yes.
Spider-Man, like, allows it to happen, I suppose, but it's more that, like, in order to save himself, he doesn't save Norman.
Well, like, no, not killing it, like, that's a staunch Batman thing. And it's not that Spider-Man is willingly going to go start killing people, but he's not as pet up about it as Batman is, so that's why you do a thing like that. Although Batman straight up murders Joker in that first film, but who cares?
But, you know, and then kills all sorts of people in returns. As we discovered. Yeah, and it's... Everything is done very evenly, I would say. Everything feels very controlled. There's no sense of wonder, excitement. There's no sense of what could happen next. It feels like everything has been carefully plotted out to happen exactly, to unfold exactly how it was intended.
Yeah.
And there's a certain... It feels a little sterile.
Yes.
As a result.
Yeah.
I'd actually say sterile in general is the best way to describe the first two Spider-Man.
Yeah, I think
there's a lack of passion
Yeah.
And there's a lack of what could happen next. It's more like, you know exactly what you're getting, and you're going to like it well enough.
Yeah. I think if you take out Kirsten Dunst and you take out Aunt May, it feels borderline cold, these first two. Like, I'd say they're kind of cookie cutter. I've had a debate with a friend about this, like, the merits of just doing, like, very rote renditions, very sort of cardboard cutout versions of characters. What's the word I'm looking for? Not stereotypes, but, you know.
Archetypes?
Yeah, like, it's safe. And
yes.
I personally would rather people took risks than just really well-executed, safe films. But that's personal preference, whatever. But this feels like the safest possible Spider-Man movie. Like, paint by numbers. Like, all right, you do this, then you do this, then you do this, then you do this. And then we go home. It's like...
And I'll even grant them with the first Spider-Man movie, the first ever big screen or major budget big screen Spider-Man movie, not the worst idea in the world.
No, absolutely. I think actually, even though I just said the first one's better than the second one, the first one is more like that than the second one. And yet I still think it's a hair better, but I mean, that's all relative. Like, but
if you need to introduce, this is, you know, a textbook first movie for a superhero introduction. And I think in that sense, if, let's say, the film's got nothing but better from here, or really went off in cool, bold, new directions, I think I could look back at this first one a bit more fondly as being like, oh, look at these simple beginnings we had.
Yes.
And I do think the film executes the origin story of Peter very well. It's hard to believe that, you know, Martin Sheen could be the second best Uncle Ben, but guess what? He is the second best Uncle Ben. They did Uncle Ben far better in the Sam Raimi Spider-Mans than they did the Mark Webb Spider-Mans.
They did. Oh,
you know, Rosemary Harris is Aunt May. That is exactly who you were expecting Aunt May to be from. If you watched a cartoon, if you read any of the comics, like, Rosemary Harris completely embodies Aunt May and actually really kind of gets to have some nuance to her character throughout the three films. You know, it's not just a one-note, like, advice machine.
No. The stuff with the mortgage and, like, forcing Peter to take her money is heartbreaking.
her work, particularly in the second one, is really part of what elevates that one up for me over the first one.
Yeah.
I mean, we might talk about it more later, but J.K. Simmons' J. Jonah Jameson that they introduced in this one is such the definitive J. Jonah Jameson.
Oh,
we are now on two straight Spider-Man interpretations that have refused to cast a new J. Jonah Jameson.
You can't.
Because they know...
It's him.
It's J.K. Simmons. And now because J.K. Simmons is in the DCEU, what a terrible name that is, by the way.
Yeah.
And what a terrible life decision for the rest of us, not probably for his bank account, but for us. We might never have J. Jonah Jameson.
I don't think you should. If you can't get him to come back, I don't want you to do it.
Yeah. Is how good J.K. Simmons was as J. Jonah Jameson. And it's obviously such a one-note cartoon character, but it really adds so much life to the Spider-Man movies. And he's one of the most vibrant characters, one of the most fun characters in the whole shebang with the Sam Raimi
keeps his
Spider-Man.
Head. Yeah, and he keeps... I think he stays... what's the term I'm looking for? He doesn't get his hands bloodied in Spider-Man 3. Like, he's still good there, just as a bad movie happening around him.
Yes, and actually, much like Aunt May, who I also don't think is bloodied up by the third one, they seem to lose a little bit more interest in him than I remembered. He seems to kind of disappear in the third one in a way that I didn't expect.
Mm. I kind of like his little... I mean, it goes away very quickly, but when Elizabeth Banks is sort of reminding him about his medication and stuff,
that was
funny for a few minutes.
Yes, that was a fun little quote-unquote arc for his character to go on.
Yeah.
It also, of course, gave Elizabeth Banks more to do.
I know, Elizabeth Banks.
Long after she did not have to do these films anymore.
In all three of these movies.
Yeah, she's in all three. Yeah. But yeah, so I think this first one is actually, I will say, a moderate thumbs up. In terms of a successful debut, not a terribly exciting movie. You know, James Franco is dreadful as Harry Osborn.
I actually texted Mike saying, is James Franco a good actor? And it's like, when you look at this, it's like, no, but he's not good at this kind of role.
No, he's not. Kirsten Dunst will get better moments to play in the second one. She felt really out of place in this first one. And honestly, the whole Spider-Man experience kind of colored my view of Kirsten Dunst as a performer. Mm. And I did not have all that high of an opinion of her as a result. I think Kirsten Dunst is a really strong performer now. And it kind of makes it clear that Spider-Man really was not the right fit for her, and they kind of wasted her talents.
No. I think she's pretty charming, but...
Yes.
I mean, you can sit there and be like, oh, she's not really playing Mary Jane, it's just a girl called that, like, she's not as feisty as the Mary Jane character is, but it's still, like, a good love interest character in a movie of this type, and, I mean... I accuse people of looking back at this with rose-tinted glass or whatever, but I can cast myself back to being a lovesick teenager and seeing this movie and being like, I get how he feels.
Sure. I think she gets better stuff to do in the second one.
Yeah.
Like almost anyone, I mean, like almost everyone, actually. So this first movie is a successful introduction.
I mean, I don't know where to talk about this, but Raimi, like his background is horror.
Yes.
And you very much feel that on all of them. And I actually think it's very telling. The first words spoken in Spider-Man 1. Does the third one have narration? I know the first two do.
Yes, the third one does.
Okay, well, in that case, all three of them open with narration from Peter. And I think it's very telling that the first words he says in Spider-Man 1, "Who am I? You sure you want to know? The story of my life is not for the faint of heart. If somebody said it was a happy little tale, if somebody told you I was just your average ordinary guy with not a care in the world, somebody lied. But let me assure you, this, like any story worth telling, is all about a girl." Straight away, that's oddly dark for, like, what actually happens in these movies. Like, yes. Sure, bad stuff happens, but, like, I don't think of... Like, that's an odd note to play. Like, Peter Parker is an optimistic guy.
These are very optimistic movies. These are very sunny movies. These are not... I had forgotten about that.
And he's being all, like, grim dark about it. Like, ooh, my horrible tale. It's like, yeah, okay, fine. No. Uncle Ben dies. That's horrible. But he is an optimistic
guy. He was an old dude, and he was going to die.
Yeah. And also, it establishes right off the bat that, like, the romance is... the third pillar of this movie. It's Spider-Man, it's the villain, it's Mary Jane. And yeah. Starting straight away with, like any good story, it's about a girl. It's like, is every good story about a girl? But, and like, then the first thing you see is her on the bus and everything. So they put her front and center from the word go.
I think that retro, I think it's the second one she's on the bus, not the first one. The retro nostalgia kind of permeating throughout, especially the first two, I think contributes to its success. I think these movies feel safe and comfortable, like pillowy. Very pillowy. Yeah.
They are warm. And, well, they're not warm.
Not warm, but pillowy.
Yeah.
you don't feel any sense of danger when you're watching them, that's for sure. You don't have to confront anything terribly, terribly scary emotionally or any level. So that brings us to the second one. And while I think... every actor is a bit more comfortable. Every actor gets a bit better to do. And I, generally speaking, prefer Alfred Molina's Otto Octavius to Willem Dafoe's Norman Osborn, sure. Even if Doc Ock becomes a bit too much of a cartoon way too quickly. There is a major, major flaw in the second one. Literally the exact same story as the first one. The only major difference is that it's, you know, Peter... has decided, or the signs have been pointing to Peter maybe being like, maybe I shouldn't be Spider-Man anymore. Maybe this is not what I want.
Yeah.
And I think that's very natural. It seems like a common thing in superhero stories for the second one to do that. I think Superman 2 does that. The Dark Knight does that. You know, recognizing the limitations of your chosen nightlife is definitely a common idea. And here it kind of manifests itself physically, like his powers are starting to become inconsistent, and they recognize there's this whole mental block with him and his powers about whether or not he actually wants to be doing this, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So that's kind of like the inverse, like that's how it's not, but it's kind of just the same. It's Spider-Man kind of deciding he wants to be Peter Parker instead of Peter Parker deciding he wants to be Spider-Man. So in a lot of ways, it is really just the same as the first one, just the inverse. But other than that, it's the exact same story. Some sort of external substance turns our far more good-hearted scientist into a villain that becomes instantly two-dimensional, the cartoon character.
Yeah.
At the very end, our villain is, you know, humanized slightly and then killed by their own doing, not by Spider-Man's doing. You know, Spider-Man and Mary Jane, once that again, have a heart-to-heart. This time they choose to be together, or more importantly, Mary Jane chooses to be with him instead of Spider-Man choosing not to be with her. Hmm. And that probably actually leads to what I think was one of my two favorite moments of the film. Kirsten Dunst, when she sees Peter, Spider-Man unmasks Peter for the first time, just fucking nails that.
She looks shocked. She looks proud that he is him. Like, everything suddenly makes sense. I think the pride is impressive, but...
To me, it's more this beautiful combination of complete and utter shock along with I knew it the whole time.
Yeah.
And, like, but it's not like I knew it. It's more like... Yeah. Well, of course.
Yeah, yeah. That's why I think the pride comes in. I think it's like always knowing that Peter was this incredibly virtuous, nice character who was about good. And then, you know, Spider-Man is like the hero of the city. And then being like, of course you're Spider-Man. Like, I got like a sense of like, I'm so glad you are Spider-Man kind of thing from her.
Yeah, and
even though she fucking clearly knows he's Spider-Man at the end of the first one, but forget that. I guess they didn't know.
We'll touch upon that in a second too, because at the end of the first one, as you just said, it seems like Mary Jane has kind of figured out that Peter is Spider-Man, or at least has a very strong hint of it.
Yeah.
And then in the second one, my other really, really top-notch scene that I love is after Peter and Aunt May have a fight about after Peter reveal, or not a fight, but a brief falling out after Peter revealed that he kind of unintentionally took action or didn't take action that led to Uncle Ben's death. And they have a scene where they come together and Aunt May just delivers this incredibly beautiful, touching monologue that convinces Peter that it is actually, you know, good to be a hero. It is good to put other people's needs before your own and all those wonderful ideas. And it seems very clear in the scene that Aunt May knows very, very well what the hell is going on with her nephew.
Oh, yeah. I think it's very clear she knows he's Spider-Man, personally. But...
And then the third one, I would say not only is that not explored on at all, but when the third one, when Peter says, oh, Spider-Man killed the Sandman, that should be a completely emotionally devastating scene for Aunt May, given that she seems to know who Spider-Man is. And that's not how I read her reaction at all. So the Sam Raimi movies occasionally like to have their cake and eat it too. But those kinds of moments where they like to have those touching moments, but do they really earn them or do they really honor them? And then that also brings us to the very last shot of the film. Mary Jane leaves her wedding to J. Jonah Jameson's son.
They should not have filmed her running through the streets wearing her wedding dress.
She should have just running through the streets.
She should have just been at his door.
And it's also kind of a weird note to play when, like, you just crushed this other dude's soul. Mm-hmm. Like, that's not something to really celebrate necessarily in that moment. Anyway, she shows up at Peter's door and she says, "It's, you know, let me make my own choices. Yeah. Like, I want to
go
be with
you, Mary Jane."
Beautiful, 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 beautiful moment. Sirens start blaring, go get him, Tiger. Why she calls him Tiger in these movies, we don't know, but, you know, Spider-Man. And then she looks out the window with this most ominous, this is going to end badly look.
It's odd. It's really odd for how, like...
And it's beautifully shot. The music is wonderful. Kirsten Dunst, once again, she's really good at not talking in these movies. And that's not a knock at her. That's a knock at the dialogue. Like, she's really just nails the scene. I'm like, oh, wow, that filled me with such emotion. And then when you brought it up, I'm like, yeah, but it doesn't make any fucking sense in the world. Like, they just had this beautiful connection. And even the third one where, I mean, things are put into trouble. I mean, things get into trouble and things don't work out for them for a lot of the third one. It doesn't really feel, like, connected to that moment. Especially since all these external factors that lead to their dissolution in the third one.
They did keep setting stuff up and then not following through on it at all. It was like they made all three in a vacuum.
I guess you could argue that her look was just this general ominous feeling of bad things could come and then bad things come in the third one. Mm-hmm. To me, the look was much more, this is going to end badly, but I don't know why.
I think you need a
more subtle payoff to that than giant alien goo flies from the sky and turns Peter into a total dick for no reason.
He's a dick before that, but yeah.
But you know what I'm saying? Is that like,
yeah.
It doesn't really connect So I think that's also another issue with these first two Sam Raimi films, is that like there's a number of great moments that are great in a bubble, and in the full context you're kind of left wondering, well, wait, what's that about?
They play a lot of revisionist history with MJ and Peter. She lays it on very thick when she confesses she loves him at the end of the first one. When she, it's like, I love you so much. It's like, that's a bit far. And then when she's all
and like... And you're also like, you're 19 and like, you barely know the guy.
Yeah, yeah. And when she says how, like, I've always been standing in your doorway, it's like, well, no. Like, you had your first earnest conversation halfway through the first movie. Like, it's a bit... It's a bit much, you know, like, he says very nice things about her, he's always been supportive of her, but, like, I think they go a bit far with it.
I think the first one should have ended more with him, or with them kind of building a connection.
Yeah.
The second one ending with her declaring her love for him, yeah. And then the third one ending with her leaving a wedding, yeah, showing him a doorstep, ominous look. Boom, perfect ending to the trilogy. Everything's way better.
And like, she plays at the beginning of the second one the kind of jilted would-be lover pretty well, I think, when she's like openly trying to get these things out of him because she knows he likes her. But
yeah,
and I do like that note they play and her being determined about
it. Oh, it's great. She's really good in the second one. Like, even just the way they do her hair and her fashion is far.
Yeah.
It felt more natural, didn't feel quite as forced, but maybe you can argue that's a realistic portrayal of post-high school versus high school.
She is kind of refreshingly, she stands up for herself more than a lot of females do in comic book movies. Like, she does get relegated a lot to eternal hostage.
Damsel in distress, yes.
And doesn't have a huge
amount. Apparently she was really pissed off about in the third one, but she was not supposed to be in the cab as a damsel in distress at the end of the third one.
Ah.
Yeah. And she got really pissed off when they moved into it.
Yeah, it does feel like they were just like, oh, MJ has to be there. Fuck it, why not?
Yeah.
But she does stand up for herself a lot. In all three of them, actually. Like, in the third one, when he's being a dick, I do like that she's like, why are you trying to make this about yourself? When he's like, oh, I know this from when I'm Spider-Man. And she's like, yeah, but we're not talking about you. We're talking about me. And like, seeing her life fall apart and him be less and less there for her is quite a good note. But...
Like a pretty true to life one in that post the high school, post college life, where it's like when things are going well for you, you kind of just think, well, everyone should be able to roll with the punches. Like, I'm rolling with the punches, like, I'm fine.
Yeah,
I mean, it's definitely happened to me over the years for sure. But I think I probably had not been giving Kirsten Dunst enough credit, and I think in the second one, especially, they did much more justice to her and the Mary Jane character. I think that story, though, really should have been the third one and not the second one.
Yeah.
The second one should have then been building a genuinely sustainable like friendship partnership. The third one should have been the why the fuck are we not together?
Yeah. Do you want to talk about Peter a bit?
He's boring. Tobey Maguire is
Tobey Maguire.
He's Melba toast.
Yeah.
He is white bread. Yeah. He is inoffensive. He is not funny. He's not funny. Like, he's not like bad funny. He is just good old Ernest Clark Kent playing Spider-Man, and I kind of like how short he is. I think that kind of actually works in Spider-Man's favor.
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
I think all the scenes where half of his mask has been blown off, he's actually pretty good in those moments. I actually think he's pretty decent at the Spider-Man aspect of it. Tobey Maguire is just not a super compelling person.
I don't think he can pull off the quips at all.
No. Spider-Man. I mean the physical aspect of it. Like, he portrayed... We might just disagree. I think he's better than I possibly had originally given credit for. But
Well, I think he plays Peter a little bit too drippy. Absolutely, you don't... Like, we're getting ahead of ourselves, but, like, Andrew Garfield played him as, like, this, like, skateboarding, semi-cool dude who's, like, a semi-hipster type thing, and, like, that's too far the other way. But I do think they lay it on so thick with, hey, Peter gets bullied, and he's kind of a dork, and...
He's getting bullied his junior year in college. Like, that just doesn't happen.
With
like,
spitballs and stuff.
Like, that just doesn't happen.
Yeah.
Like, the word, like... And a so much more realistic version, which would be he's sitting up front like a nerd in college and answering all the questions, and people in the back are rolling their eyes at him. That is the extent of college bullying in America.
Yeah,
like
in the classroom. Yeah. Same thing like, here. It's just you find people quietly annoying and you talk about them behind their back, but no one like does anything in university here. Yeah, and just. Oh, it's too much. Like, he's such a sad sack about, like, everything. Like, and he starts to talk out loud to himself a lot more as they go on, and he says these really cringy things. They're particularly bad in the third one, but the third one's bad anyway. But, like, him sitting there in the restaurant talking out loud to himself is terrible. His little monologue practicing the phone call to Mary Jane, like, that's almost there, but just... There's so much of this stuff where it's like, okay, dude, just come on now. And just, yeah, I never liked that. I always picture Peter Parker as, like, somewhere in the middle. I didn't think of him as, like, a habitual, like, bullying victim, complete nerd. But I also didn't picture him as, like, in any way... Like, he's an in-betweener. He's, like, a lost yes. kid, a typical kid.
Yes.
Not a cardboard yes. cutout of a geek or a jock or anything.
Nor does he do anything in the high school or college scenes that would make you think, well, of course he would be picked on.
Yeah.
Like, that's not to, like, to justify picking on, but there are certain attributes of people that you're like, well, yes, that person would be picked on in high school. Like, and he doesn't really encapsulate that in any way. It's bizarre.
Yeah.
And forced and not particularly... entertaining or satisfying.
I forget which one it's in. I think it's the third one, but Mary Jane calls him a dork, or she's like, you're such a dork. And it's like, at no point in those first two movies did she make any comments whatsoever about his intelligence. And like, we know he's smart, but like, there's no one who's like, oh man, Peter, he's so smart. It just felt really odd for her to suddenly go there when she seems to just think, yeah, he's smart. No big deal. Like, him being, quote-unquote, the geek and her being popular is never an issue for her. And then they suddenly play that note a little bit.
And I think that has a lot to do with the first film rushing to that Peter Parker and Mary Jane Watson are meant to be together idea.
Yeah.
Which should not have been the case at all. Well, I think, generally speaking, it felt kind of annoying that Mary Jane and Harry started hooking up in the first one. Like, that felt a little rushed. But you could believe that.
Well, he's a more assertive person than Peter.
He's more assertive. You know, he's more impressive outwardly in some ways. Yeah. You know, more stable in a lot of ways. And, you know, he actually asked her out.
Exactly.
But that should have just been a great avenue for Mary Jane and Peter to become friends. Like, that shouldn't have been a path to her declaring her undying love for him at the end of the movie.
Yeah.
I think that to me is just such a, in retrospect, such a big issue.
Yeah. And like, we've talked about the horror stuff. There's a lot of like ominous music and lightning flashes and transformations and like Doc Ock getting when the tentacles come to life and murder all the surgeons and stuff. Yeah. It's all very horror movie-y.
There's always, what I would say is there's always one Evil Dead sequence in all three films where you just walked into a different movie. And I think it's kind of cute. Like, it doesn't really like ruin anything for it, but it feels a little out of place, but at the same time, it's pretty harmless in the grand scheme of things.
Yeah.
I think before we move on to the third one, like, we really got to talk about all the random actors in these movies. I mean, first, Joe Manganiello, right? That's his name?
Yeah, as Flash Thompson. Yeah.
He's about to be Deadshot. Or not Deadshot, he's about to be...
Deathstroke.
Deathstroke, and maybe or maybe not made Batman movie.
Joel McHale
has a two-minute cameo as a really poorly acted bank manager in Spider-Man 2.
It's weird seeing him with bad hair and, like, not being... like the cool
Jeff
dude.
Winger.
Yeah, he's Jeff Winger. He's always Jeff Winger now.
Emily Deschanel gets to play an apartment concierge, maybe? I don't know. But that was kind of weird.
Octavia Spencer, is that her name? As the wrestling sign up lady.
Yes, she's in that. Let's see, there's a bunch of others too.
Elizabeth Banks, as we said. Daniel Day
has a recurring role.
Yeah, Daniel Day-Kim as one of Doc Ock's scientists.
Yes, absolutely. I noticed that this time.
Joy Bryant as a bystander somewhere.
She gets 10 seconds of screen time. You know, I mean, probably the Elizabeth Banks one is the weirdest one in the sense that, like...
because I didn't.
She's
know
on the who, back cover of the second DVD for some reason. Like she's in. The
I bet that's a re-release because I didn't know who she was when I first saw all three of these. Maybe the third one I might have, but
I definitely knew her by the third one. I maybe the second one, maybe not. But by the third one, I definitely was like, "Wow, Elizabeth Banks is in these movies." And who was she playing? She's been in all three of them. What? Yeah, yeah. It just—it's kind of like this weird time capsule of
it is,
what random people pop up in these movies that they're not cameos in any way. They're just unfamous people at the time, now famous, who happen to be in these movies, which but, you know doesn't happen that often where they're all in so many of them.
I do think
Baker.
Oh yeah, sorry.
Gets to tease Clang,
the lizard.
The lizard. He's in the second and the third one in very glorified bit parts, with the idea that he would eventually be the lizard. Apparently, originally it was supposed to be the third one. He was supposed to be the lizard, and then it became the fourth one.
Oh,
but
okay.
It did not happen. Then it was supposed to be the fourth one, but then the fourth one never happened. And I have an inkling that it would not have happened anyway.
Sure.
Bruce Campbell from The Evil Dead gets to make a cameo as different characters, each of the three. Asif Mandi gets to play a pizza store owner in the second one. There's just a bunch of random fucking people in these movies. It's very weird.
There are. Before we move on to the third one and just, you know, tearing that apart, I do think we do need to just at least say out loud, like, there are some, like, truly iconic scenes, in particularly that first movie, like the upside down kiss. Him realizing he has abs, him climbing up the wall for the first time, the train scene in the second one, the other train scene in the first one. I guess it's a cable car or whatever in the first one. Just a lot of stuff that is just instantly recognizable from all of these. And I do like that they try and make, like, true to the character, Spider-Man's more about saving people than fighting bad guys. I feel Batman is like a combative character, and a lot of modern superhero movies are about taking down the big bad guy. Spider-Man is happy to be out there every day just saving everyday folks, and I do like that there is a lot of emphasis on that, and they always do that big scene in every movie where, you know, he just saves a lot of people from like natural disasters, all sorts of stuff. Like Batman, if he was there and something was happening, he would help, but it's not like he's running out to stop people from like falling off a bridge or whatever. And I do like a cool, the reason Spider-Man is the single greatest comic book character ever, or one of the reasons, it's that relatability and seeing how fallible he is as Peter Parker. And I do like that they go there strongly in the second one, which is why he goes through his crisis of, you know, this dude is late for work, he's struggling in his personal life because of his professional life and everything. Like, I do like that they go there, and like there's a scene where he opens his closet and in it is the Spider-Man suit and a like dinner suit, and it's like you see him living in this crappy apartment, and you know, it's good that they make him that everyman, and they're not afraid to do that. While a lot of superheroes are cooler than cool or more tragic than tragic, so that there's like a romanticism to how tortured they are or whatever. And that's not who this is. This is a dude who has everyday problems, who has to just suck it up and go be the greatest superhero in the world, and then back to his sometimes bad life. And I do think for all the like sort of safe one note stuff they do in the first two, I do appreciate that they did take the time to try and sell that concept, so that when he is going through that crisis of should I be Spider-Man, like you get it, like in some ways his life would be better if he wasn't Spider-Man, but then he does come back to it because he can't help but do it. And I like that he's not instantly rewarded by getting Mary Jane just because he's given up being Spider-Man, and it's when he goes back to it that he gets her almost. So I do like all of that. I just wanted to speak my piece on Spider-Man generally.
No, I think those are all important points. And that actually reminds me of what's possibly the most important point, the biggest gripe I have with the Sam Raimi Spider-Mans, which is the theatrical full-length trailer for the second one.
Mm-hmm.
Way back in early 2004, when I saw this theatrical trailer,
mm-hmm.
Whole one, you know, you're not choosing to watch a trailer, you're in the movie theater, you gotta watch trailers,
you gotta
search it out on the YouTube. This trailer explained Spider-Man is Spider-Man. Spider-Man chooses not to be Spider-Man. They show the image of him throwing the suit in the trash can.
Yep.
And then they do this wonderful montage of him being, I am Spider-Man.
Oh, cool.
And they,
do I need to see the movie then? Or
his choice. Dramatic music. They showed the entire character arc in the whole theatrical trailer. I remember sitting there 15 years old being like, what in the fuckity fuck was that? Why on earth would you possibly go pay the money to see this movie when you know the entire trailer?
Mm-hmm.
Of course, I did pay to see the money in the movie in the theaters, owned the DVD, and the movie was a huge success. So what the fuck do I know? But still, please don't fucking do that. It's fucking annoying.
It is. This is the problem.
Don't like it.
Yeah.
It's one thing to give too much of the comedic relief away. It's one thing to reveal too many of the action scenes away. To give the entire character fuck arc, come on. It's terrible.
Speaking of terrible, though, I think it's time to talk about Spider-Man 3.
This is one of the worst movies I've ever seen that still feels like a professionally made movie. Like, this is not 1994 Fantastic Four. This isn't even 2015 Fantastic Four, which is not a movie. It is a...
They ran out of time reality, put what they had on the screen.
Mad Libs.
Yeah.
Just random shit thrown together, and they hoped no one would notice. Spider-Man 3, at least 2007, same crew, same actor, same director, same writers, I think, is a movie. It feels like a movie. It is one of the shittiest fucking movies I have ever seen. Virtually nothing about this movie works on any level. Other than the fact that Peter Parker becoming a huge self-absorbed douche results in a lot of people being like, dude, stop being a douche.
Yeah,
that is the only thing. That is the only thing about this that felt true to life in any way, exciting. And I'm not saying it's exciting. I'm saying like nothing else about this movie works other than that kind of basic idea. And I actually think that tiny little kernel of an idea probably could have led to a good movie. Probably could have led to a good Venom movie.
Not possible.
Instead, we have just this disastrous clusterfuck of complete and utter shite.
Yep.
Some of the worst special effects you'll ever see.
Yeah.
One of the worst, Neo versus Agent Smith, Superman versus Zod, Peter Quinn versus Ego, Alien versus Alien fights between Spider-Man and Harry Osborn to kick off the movie with some of the worst CGI you'll ever see.
It's a lot worse when it's humans versus like the costumed characters. You'll notice whenever like it's Peter or a person doing CGI, it looks awful.
Yeah, it's a fucking disaster. We are treated to two solo singing performances from Kirsten Dunst. We are treated to two dance scenes.
Famous hater of song and dance, Mike Thomas strikes again.
I do not like song and dance.
They're still not good as a person that does like song and dance.
We get
an amnesia story.
We get our first amnesia story in Marvel Cinematic History. Harry Osborn plays an amnesia victim for, I think, the solid 90 minutes in the middle of this movie.
Yeah, for no reason. There's no reason for that at all. Just so it's like, well, we can't just have Harry be in a coma for 90 minutes.
Yeah.
But we wrote that they fight at the beginning, so...
Yes. We get the first on-screen portrayal of Eddie Brock Venom, who doesn't show up in this 2-hour, 15-minute movie. He doesn't show up until about the 35-minute mark, like a minute or two before.
Just saunters in. Who are you? Oh, I'm Eddie Brock.
Doesn't become Venom until the final 30 minutes of the movie.
Yep.
And is played by, while I love Topher Grace, just completely...
There's nothing. There is nothing here.
There's nothing there. It's a total two-dimensional character. But unlike the first two Spider-Man, this movie decided to get more ambitious. So not only do we have Harry playing a villain from the beginning and like 20 minutes in the second third of the movie, we have Eddie Brock and Venom playing a pest throughout the movie and then the big villain at the end. We have a third villain.
We do.
The Sandman. Thomas Hayden Church, hot off his first and only Oscar nomination. Seemed like, wow, what an inspired choice, taking a chance on a super fun actor to play a villain. What was the role he was nominated for? It was for playing the superbly funny, charismatic, outgoing, ridiculous man-child in Sideways. So in this movie, they have him play quiet, reserved meat stick who says nothing but, "I'm not a bad person. I did it for my daughter.
I've just had bad luck.
I'm not a bad guy.
It wasn't me."
For
so shit.
The entire movie, who has the worst, some of the worst special effects in a movie that already has bad special effects that you've ever seen as a Sandman.
It's particularly when he fades away at the end.
Yes. And all the while, this entire movie is basically just a series of completely ridiculous and unfortunate coincidences happening, leading to 95% of the conflict.
Yeah. Men in Black 2's opening happens right next to Peter. That's great.
Yeah. Like, it is just moment after moment of, if it wasn't for the fact that these two characters were here at this particular moment in time for no reason whatsoever, this movie would not exist. And that happens over and over and over again in this movie.
Venom and Sandman meeting at the end is fucking awful. Just swinging in shadow and then, there you are. And then he just walks away and they have this little conversation. It's awful.
This movie is a complete and utter embarrassment.
Yeah.
If the only thing I will give it credit for over the first two is if the first two were ridiculously over the top safe, this one is ambitious.
Yes.
This is true.
They did fly too close to the sun.
Unfortunately, it is blind ambition that fell victim to the fallacy that more is better. More is just simply more here, and more shit is simply just more fucking shit.
I mean, too many villains, too much random, CG is bad. Why the fuck is Peter Parker just suddenly a complete dickhead in this movie? Like, from memory, it's like, the symbiote takes over him and then he becomes bad. It's like, no, before that happens...
Oh, no, he's a complete fucking dickhead.
Yeah, they love me. Oh, my God. Oh, yeah, just kiss me. It'll be great. Like, what the fuck has happened to this dude? Why is he doing any of it? Because, I mean, that's traditionally, like, when he first gets his powers, he's cocky about it. And then the Uncle Ben thing humbles him forever. Like, there's not really any point where Spider-Man, to my knowledge, I mean, I haven't read every Spider-Man comic ever. To my knowledge, he doesn't ever really get big-headed about it because of what happened when he did it before. He's taught a karmic lesson the second that he's cocky. And we see that in this wrestling scene where, like, he's feeling himself a bit. Like, he gets a bit sassy. And then it leads to his uncle's death, and then he changes for it. And, like, that's the idea here. And for him to get so... like, in love with his own... like, he's literally standing there watching himself on a big screen and, like, enamored with this parade they're having for him and talking at length about how tough it is being an icon in the restaurant. And it's like, what the fuck, dude? Like,
It is a disaster on every significant level.
Yeah.
What, pray tell me, are the handful of positives you glean... cinematic experience.
I already blew one of them on Jameson's little moment with the pills.
Yes,
he's generally fine. I do like Bruce Campbell as the maitre d' with the champagne and the wedding ring and all that. Like that's funny. Oh, it's cute.
So 30 seconds of comic relief so far.
Yeah. Pretty much. I like that Mary Jane gives Pete a shit for being an asshole, but like, why did you make him an asshole in the first place? Like, we could have avoided this.
And I'll say this. They make Peter so unbelievably unlikable, it made perfect sense to Mary Jane. She's like, you know what? Fuck this. Like, this guy's not going to get any better. If he's this much of an asshole, I am going to go running back to Harry.
Yeah. It is haunting how evocative of me that scene is where he buys that black suit and does that dance straight outside. Like that was a depressing look in a mirror when I saw that. More than one person has said that scene reminds me of you. I'm like, cool, reassess your life, Matt. But it's bad. Him dancing around with his emo haircut and pointing at people in the street and fucking awful. And I do remember when I marathoned through the Spider-Man cartoon when I first got Netflix, being shocked when they do a Venom episode and Spider-Man dances around in that. So they didn't actually invent this, and they possibly even did it as an homage, but time and place for homages, guys. Like, it's embarrassing.
The only other one I got is that the portrait of Willem Dafoe is one of the funniest fucking things ever, and I really want it, and it doesn't... even an image of it doesn't even fucking exist. You have to, like, take a screenshot of it. It's... This is like the greatest portrait I've ever seen. He is so ridiculously over the top in every way. It is so perfect. It is so perfect.
In a world where the real world really takes off and we become internet millionaires, I will buy you that portrait.
Thank you.
That's
thank
all right. You. We will hang it in the offices of the Real World Inc.
You know, we didn't even mention that James Cromwell embraced Dallas Howard in this movie as Gwen and Captain Stacy.
Yeah.
They really don't get much to do.
No,
I think they just wanted to give Kirsten Dunst a break from being a damsel in distress for a bit, but she was actually originally supposed to be in the taxi cab at the end.
Oh, okay. That would make sense because Brock is, like, jilted about her, but...
Yeah.
Like, is the implication that he's making up that he's going out with her? Because he walks in
There's a deleted scene where Gwen dumps him in front of her father.
Oh, okay. I wondered if maybe he'd like made it up, but
it was definitely in the script that they were legitimately together. Mm. Now, Bill Nunn, who we haven't mentioned yet, is Robbie Robertson, still there. Elizabeth Banks is still there. Ted Raimi is still there. Willem Dafoe and Cliff Robertson make a cameo again, as they did in the second one.
Yeah.
Cliff Robertson looks like 100 years older, 5 years later. It did not look like the same Uncle Ben that died in the first movie.
No.
It's hard to believe he held on for like another 4 or 5 years after this movie, to be perfectly honest. And also, Willem Dafoe aged an oddly high amount in the 5 years since, so that was actually kind of weird. But, well, I mean, unavoidable, obviously.
We suspect Willem Dafoe to be a supernatural creature anyway, so...
Apparently, Joe Manganiello has a cameo at the end.
He's in the credits, but I couldn't see him in the movie.
Supposedly, he's at Harry's funeral.
Oh.
Yes, I just Googled it, and yes, he is creepily staring at Mary Jane when she puts flowers on.
Sweet.
Harry's great.
That's what you want.
You know, maybe he's just constipated. Yeah. This movie is just a complete fucking disaster.
Peter and Mary Jane don't really make up in a way that is... You can say off-screen he explained, oh, that was the symbiote, but, like, fuck you, dude. Like, you've got some splaining to do.
Yes, which is unfortunate, because once again, I really like the ending shot of them just holding hands for a second, kind of being like, you don't know exactly what's going to happen.
Yeah.
There's a certain, like, ambiguity to it all, but, like, for people who have been in actual, you know, long-term relationships where there has been, you know, temporary not been a relationship, you could kind of totally see how the connection would be so strong that simple just holding up a hand would mean so much. But in this case, it's so ridiculously extreme because of how much of a dick he was being that it doesn't really feel earned. But then again, as we've discovered, that there's a number of the moments in these movies where it doesn't really feel earned. That would otherwise be good in a bubble. This movie is just a complete fucking disaster. Recently, there was an editor's cut that leaked. There is not a single way you can turn this into a good movie. There's not a single way.
No, it's too much. Like, tell a compelling Sandman story, or tell a Venom story, or tell a Harry story. Don't try and do all three. And especially...
I could see a Harry and Venom story working well in the same movie. I could see it. I think also... But
I think Venom and Sandman make each other redundant. Completely.
Yes. Yeah, no, that was too much.
You could do Harry and one of the others, but...
Yeah, I think you can't have two villains that are just two villains. But I think the idea of kind of Eddie Brock showing up in this world as Peter's life is taking off kind of does work.
Mm.
And also, so the comparison between Harry, Brock, and Peter could theoretically be interesting.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, they don't come anywhere close to that here. That's all it had.
And they took an extra year to make it.
I know. That's the big thing to me. Like, we were talking about this. To me, I always think 3 years is the right length between films in a series. Two, you feel like they're rushing it out. Like, look at the difference between X-Men Apocalypse and Days of Future Past. X-Men Apocalypse needed another year. Clearly needed another year.
Yep.
But with this one, like... took 3 years and it just feels like a mess.
There's so many clear like stitch marks from cutting things together that were originally different, and like there's all these stories that go out about the plans for the fourth one with Black Cat and the Vulture and Shocker and the Lizard and all these different names that were bandied about. And just, this was such a fucking garbage fire that they walked away from. And Sam Raimi has said he hates Spider-Man 3. Like, he's not happy.
Well, I think the bigger issue is that Sam Raimi was hoping to make a fourth one, from what I read.
Yeah.
And I think the main two players were down for it. I think, though, Sony was just like, God, this, everyone just costs so much money. Like, we spent $258 million on this movie.
I bet it made money.
Oh, it definitely did, but it's like it's only going to keep costing more and more money.
Yeah. That's why they reboot.
And there was we didn't get into it, but there was a huge blow up between the first and the second one, where Sony actually announced that Jake Gyllenhaal was going to be the new Spider-Man because of negotiations with Tobey Maguire broke down to such a high degree.
I can't imagine him being like a power player in terms of. I can't imagine him being assertive like ever, but.
Well, you know, he's going to make some completely unfounded speculation. He is best buddies with Leo DiCaprio for decades now, and I think they just operate differently. They operate the older star system a little bit more than I think we're... They sure. operate from a...
You can't make this movie without me.
Yes, kind of strength, kind of position that we don't get to see quite as often.
Yeah, stars are really Downey under Jr. the thumbs of studios these days a lot more. Like, Idris Elba can't get out of his contract no matter what he tries to do. You got Affleck attempting it, but...
Wait, is Idris Elba trying to get out of his Marvel contract?
He was apparently furious that he had to do that cameo in Avengers 2. Like, to the point he was like, I want out, but obviously they talked him back in, but... I think he's fine with Thor. I don't think he likes the fact that he has to come when they call if he's available. For like Avengers or anything else they see fit to do. Natalie Portman, I know, was like, well, she's fucking bad in Thor. And I feel they've just
so I just googled this. This is the two different within a month. These are two headlines I'm seeing. Idris Elba says working on Marvel movies is torture. Idris Elba dismisses belief that he wants out of his Marvel contract. Which one?
Well, I doubt he wants out, but like I think it is annoying when. I don't know, they come calling
and you want to do something else.
Yeah, I mean, it's a whole separate issue because why would you sign a contract that says we own you for 9 films or whatever the fuck? But
yeah,
it is annoying, I'm sure. Anyway, but these films, for most people, this is definitive Spider-Man. For most people, Spider-Man 2 is like a top 5 comic book movie. For most people, Doc Ock is like a top 5 comic book villain. Tobey Maguire is Spider-Man... Kirsten Dunst is Mary Jane, etc., etc. I have always rejected that stance. They're fine. The third one's obviously trash, but one and two, like, they're good movies. They're just not great. And I think the character deserves a hell of a lot better because, you know, I will debate anyone all day long about Spider-Man being the best comic book character there is. I don't think Tobey Maguire ever really quite cut it for me. He's not good at one-liners as Spider-Man. He's clearly not physically, or they may have just not chosen not to do this, but like there's so much CG when he's being Spider-Man. It's actually what I like about Tom Holland is that he can do a bunch of flips, so I'm more inclined to believe, yeah, that dude's doing that. Whereas all of this seems like CG. It's also safe, and yeah, I just they're very okay.
They're very okay. They are perfectly watchable, very easy to digest. And almost insultingly easy to digest. You're not challenged in any way when you watch those first two movies.
And maybe that's why people like them. I don't know, because like,
I mean, they are
everyone fucking saw them. Like,
I mean, I think fast food would be too much of an insult, but they're
unashamedly popcorn movies. Whereas now every superhero movie is attempting to be either The Dark Knight or The Avengers.
Yes, and most are failing.
Yes, they
but,
are.
Most do not aim for the middle quite like these two did.
Right. It very much feels like Sam Raimi attempted to deliver the most like easy, digestible Spider-Man movie possible. The first one, it kind of feels like he was attempting to deliver a very cost-efficient Spider-Man. Obviously, the salaries would have ballooned up, but like it seems like it was like, all right, I got this. Like a game management quarterback, he's not going to win you the game, but he's not going to lose it for you. You know,
I do wish. They got a fourth one just to conclude what they had built in a more meaningful, less awful way.
Yeah.
I mean, like, James Franco's work in Spider-Man 3 is some of the worst acting you'll ever see.
It's garbage. He's garbage in all of them. I started saying to you, like, oh, he's actually all right in this second one. And then after I said it, he's screaming at Doc Ock in the lab and everything. I was like, oh, I take that back.
It's literally just that opening birthday party scene where he's a tolerable human being.
And
then maybe a little bit when he's strong-arming Otto to talk to Peter.
Yeah.
Other than that, he's terrible, basically, in these entire movies.
But, I mean, you got Jameson, you've got Aunt May. They're great.
Yeah, they deserve the fourth one. I think if they did a far more intimate, far more focused, I don't want to say exactly like the first two, but something closer to the scope of the first two, you know, that would have felt more appropriate for this version of Spider-Man, if nothing else.
I'm waiting for the day where, like, a studio will be brave enough to do a full-on genre movie that just happens to have superheroes in it, like... What if, like, you never saw him? I mean, obviously, no one would spend money on this, but in a world where anything can happen, a world where, like, you see him enter and exit scenes of Spider-Man, but then it's just a movie about the relationship between Peter and whether it's Mary Jane or Gwen Stacy or whoever. Just, like, not necessarily a rom-com, but just sort of a movie that's about a man and a woman, and it just so happens the man is Spider-Man, you know? Like, that would be brave. I don't think it's ever happening, but...
Well, yeah, to me, I always look at the movie The Martian as a perfect example of a movie I would love to see Marvel or someone like Marvel make, where it's just characters that we know and are familiar with, but just in a completely absurd story, not typical of a superhero movie at all.
Yeah.
I don't think we are all that close to getting there, although maybe a little bit closer after Logan was such a runaway hit in every regard, at least.
Well, I guess that's going to do it for Raimi Spider-Man. Very okay. There's crime happening in New Jersey.
Listen, I work in New York.
To the shock of Murderville, USA.
Yes, it's very dangerous. I don't know what to tell you.
So that's Raimi Spider-Man. Very okay as our verdict. A lot of stuff that is undoubtedly iconic. A lot of stuff that, like, you can't really do anymore because... Spider-Man, like, this is ingrained. I never want to see Spider-Man get bitten again. I never want to see the Waynes get shot again. You know, like, we can't do this anymore.
Uncle Ben, I mean, I think, and we'll get into this, obviously, next week with the Mark Webb Spider-Man. It's like, we should never see Peter get bit by the spider. We should never see Uncle Ben die again.
No.
We should never see the Osborn plot again.
Nope.
That's done.
Like, Spider-Man's got a lot of villains. We don't need to repeat any of them, to be honest. We're going to see Venom again, obviously, but, like, come on now.
I don't want to say they should do J. Jonah Jameson again. I just think they need to get J.K. Simmons to do it. I think that role is J.K. Simmons. Anybody else? I mean, like, I can't picture anybody else playing it.
No.
Yeah, it's kind of weird. It's as much as I don't have much passion for these movies, they did kind of establish certain things that are just, like, they're kind of the definitive cinematic portrayal of them for Spider-Man, and we just don't need them anymore.
Exactly. Yeah, they served a purpose. They are a blueprint that will live on quite a while, I would say. But we need to do different things, and they did some different things. Did Mark Webb and Andrew Garfield, which we will be talking about next week. So,
yes.
I've been Matt Waters. He's been Mike Thomas. EntertheRealWorld.com with two E's, like a film reel. It's a pun. SoundCloud.com/MikeandMatt.
It was a great spy idea.
End of podcast. Someone told me love will all save us.